This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran dismisses recent claims by the CIA director on Tehran-Moscow cooperation, saying they are part of Washington's propaganda war against Tehran. The UK declares a new military aid package for Ukraine that includes precision-guided missiles, despite Russia's warnings that Western arms only prolong the war. And several French cities witness clashes between police and football fans following France's defeat in the dramatic World Cup final against Argentina. Welcome to World News from the reigning capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Our top story and our bulletin for this hour starts here in Iran, which has described as unfounded claims by the head of the US spy agency regarding Iran-Russia cooperation over the Ukraine war. The Iranian Foreign Ministry spokesman Nasser Kanani said baseless accusations leveled against Iran by the CIA over the Ukraine conflict are part of Washington's propaganda campaign against Iran. He said as part of their groundless political claims and illegal moves, U.S. authorities question conventional Iran-Russian defense and military cooperation. The spokesman noted this PR exercise by the White House is based on lies and deception and comes with different aims, namely exerting political pressure on Iran, provoking Iranophobia, and covering up Washington's warmongering. Kanani reiterated Tehran-Moscow cooperation on different fronts, including in the defense domain, is in line with the two nations' common interests. He said the two sides are expanding their cooperation in compliance with their rights and international commitments. Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi, meanwhile, has denounced the West, the U.S. in particular, for using human rights as a tool against independent nations. Raisi made the remark while meeting with the visiting Nicaraguan Foreign Minister Denis Moncada. He said the U.S. has failed in its calculations to hatch new plots against sovereign countries. The Iranian president highlighted the expansion of ties between countries with convergent policies as one of the ways to thwart pressures exerted by arrogant powers. The Nicaraguan Foreign Minister, for his part, pointed to Iran's successful resistance against U.S. sanctions and pressure. Moncada also called for the expansion of trade and economic cooperation between Tehran and Managua. Elsewhere, Afghans are calling for an independent and transparent investigation into dozens of summary killings by the UK Special Air Service troops in Afghanistan after years of reports that elite British forces killed the civilians in cold blood. Rahmatullah Baghban reports from Kabul.
Afghan people have been calling for transparent and impartial investigations into crimes and wrongdoings by NATO forces on their soil. Among them, relatives of victims of the NATO war in southern Helmand province are demanding justice for the killing of 54 unarmed people by British Special Air Service troops there. The dead include children. Afghans want the murderers should be held accountable.
Helmand province witnessed deadly night raids and airstrikes by NATO forces, especially those of the UK. Besides, civilian captives were tortured and shot dead. In one case, children were thrown off military planes. I remember so many atrocities by the foreign forces in which civilians were harmed. We call for those British and American perpetrators to be tried in an impartial and transparent court. They should be brought to account and victims should receive compensation.
However, the UK government has announced the start of an inquiry into wrongdoings by its forces in Afghanistan, but some experts say only transparent probes by independent bodies can help make headway with the case. They believe investigations by foreign governments could cover up the facts about the gross violations at the hands of their forces in Afghanistan. During the two-decade U.S. invasion, Afghanistan witnessed much disgrace by NATO troops. More and more facts are emerging regarding unlawful killings and gross violations by foreign forces on Afghan soil. The U.S. war on Afghanistan has left many Afghans in great suffering. People here are calling for accountability and justice for years of gross violation by the NATO troops. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Palestinians have come under increasing settler attacks in the past couple of months. The settlers have drawn public anger by storming the Al-Aqsa Mosque and killing two Palestinians in the occupied West Bank. We have discussed the issue in our news review program.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned the latest raid on Al-Aqsa Mosque by Israeli settlers. Hamas says such incursions are provocative and very dangerous. Mona Kandil is a correspondent joining us from occupied Ramallah. Sadin Nimr is a professor of political science at Birzeit University, also joining us from Ramallah. Welcome to you both. So Mona Kandil, it's the unfortunate death of these two brothers. Really, the pictures speak volumes. Tell us a little bit more about what happened there. And maybe it's a good time to ask you, if you can, Mona, since we're drawing this year on the Christian calendar to an end, as to why there has been such an uptick with the Palestinian lives being lost. At this point, I think it's well over 240 Palestinians that have lost their lives since the beginning of the year.
Well, the story is that Palestinians were a group of Palestinians, or five brothers, were returning back from Nablus. They were checking preparations for the wedding of their sister, and they were returning back from Nablus to Ramallah. Near the Israeli military checkpoint of Za'atara, their vehicle broke down, so they exited the vehicle, and they were trying to fix one of the vehicle's tire. But an Israeli settler deliberately ran his car into them, killing two brothers, Muhammad and Muhannad Mtir, from the Kalandia refugee camp. The Israeli military and the Israeli regime tried to show that what happened is only an accident, but it's pretty sure that it was ramming his vehicle. The settler has deliberately rammed his vehicle, knowing at the end of the day that even if he killed any Palestinian, none of the Israeli settlers or the Israeli soldiers would be sued for their crimes. At the time, the Israeli military continued to commit and insist to commit more crimes against the Palestinians, killing not only Palestinian fighters and members of resistance groups, but the Israeli forces have killed since the beginning of the year children, women, elderly, unarmed Palestinians. People were killed in cold blood, and even human rights organizations have accused the Israeli soldiers for committing crimes and killing people in cold blood.
Yeah, Saad Nimr, many Palestinians have been killed in cold blood over the past year especially. And my question to you is, this has occurred without the new administration really taking a hold of really ruling Israel, or Palestine, I should say. When we take a look at the very extreme, from what we understand, members that are going to be part of this, like the politician by the name of Ben-Gvir, are we looking at more, I guess, attacks on Palestinians, given that this year clocked in a record amount to have been killed?
Yes, that's exactly what we are expecting. This year, it was really a bloody year for the Palestinians, and the number of Palestinians who were killed and became martyrs by the Israeli troops and the settlers is really unexpected and not comparable with any other year since 2005 till now, according to the United Nations report. So it's quite obvious that the Israeli are now running more and more into this clashes with the Palestinians by firing at the Palestinians without even thinking and without even any cause for this kind of killing for the Palestinians. And that's quite clear what happened in Jenin just 2 weeks ago, killing three people, innocent people, normal people who were in the streets just in the morning, and it's not even resistance. It's quite clear what happened last night and last evening in Nablus. purpose. And it's going on and on. The children have been killed. Like, you know, also a week ago, this girl child, she was killed on the roof of her town and on her house. It's quite clear that this government, anyway, is, you know, taking all these atrocities. Now we are expecting even more with two personalities added to the new government, if Netanyahu declare it, Smotrich and Ben-Gvir. We are used to the atrocities by the Israelis because the whole country, or whatever it is called, it's a colonialist, racist regime, and always they do that. But now we are expecting a little bit more than before. I'm not really surprised of what's coming on, because Israel is going more and more into this fascist regime, and even the Israelis themselves, they knew that it's going for fascist regime now, and there are lots of criticism to the new government. However, for us as Palestinians, we are going to continue our struggle, we are going to continue our resistance to this occupation. Regardless, we have seen more violence by the Israelis, and we've seen less, so we don't, you know, make a big difference between all these governments, because this is the policy of this racist colonialist state.
Thank you so much for that. Saad Nimr, professor of political science at Birzeit University. Mona Kandil, thank you so much, a correspondent there from occupied Ramallah. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
Turning elsewhere now, the United Kingdom has confirmed delivery of another military aid package to Ukraine. Nearly 10 months into the Moscow-Kiev war, the British Ministry of Defense says the new package includes two precision-guided Brimstone missiles. The anti-tank weapons are capable of salvo attacks and autonomously finding targets once it reaches a designated target area. The ministry says the aid could play a crucial role in stalling Russian advances into the Ukraine territory. The new UK military aid comes as the West has already provided Kiev with billions of dollars worth of military aid to boost Ukraine's defense capabilities. Russia has warned time and again that continued supply of Western weapons and equipment to Kiev will only prolong the war. Violence in the streets of France after the country's football team lost the FIFA World Cup title. Clashes broke out in the capital, Paris, as well as in Lyon, among other cities. In Paris, the scuffles erupted as police charged into the crowd to disperse bystanders. Also in Lyon, police used water cannons and tear gas to push back a mob which fought back, hurling projectiles at officers. Officials say 15 people have been arrested. France were beaten by Argentina on penalties in the final match of the FIFA World Cup on Sunday. North Korea says it has conducted what it calls an important final phase test for the development of a spy satellite it seeks to complete by April next year. Pyongyang says it launched the satellite on Sunday from a station in the northwestern part of the country. It says the test was aimed at reviewing the country's capability of satellite imaging, data transmission and ground control systems. This comes a day after the South Korean and Japanese militaries reported the North fired two ballistic missiles into the Sea of Japan. Pyongyang has carried out a slew of missile tests this year. It says that these are in response to the United States' growing presence in the region and its joint military drills with South Korea and Japan. Peru's political crisis continues. At least 18 people have been killed in the protests against the current government, headed by the former Vice President Dina Boluarte, who was not elected by popular votes. There are now speculations that the U.S. may have been involved in the overthrow of the democratically elected President Pedro Castillo.
When it comes to Peru, the country is unraveling quickly. Just last week, Peru's president, Pedro Castillo, was removed from office. His charge, rebellion, which came after he announced that he would shut down Congress and install a government of exception. This occurred just before he was due to face an impeachment vote. Then came his arrest, charged with allegedly breaching constitutional order. But these accusations were not enough. He was also accused of an attempted coup. Enter Castillo's vice president, Dina Boluarte. She also accused the president of a coup attempt. And just a few short hours later, she was sworn in as the new president, becoming the first female head of state in Peru's history. Boluarte called for a political truce and the installation of a national unity government. No surprise that the coup set up mass protests all across Peru. This is while the unelected government ordered a violent crackdown, with police to have killed numerous protesters. Yet things have moved rather too quickly, leading one to conclude that there may be foreign hands at play, in this instance, from the U.S. For example, just 2 days before a coup against its elected President Castillo, the ex-CIA agent and U.S. ambassador to Peru, Lisa Kenna, met with Peru's defense minister. And there are reports that Peru's defense minister, who's a retired brigadier general, ordered the military to turn against Castillo.
Los malos elementos que están pasando de generar acciones violentistas a generar acciones terroristas, lo cual está penado con los máximos niveles por la ley nacional.
In another example, the U.S. ambassador to Peru, Lisa Kenna, met with Peru's unelected leader, Dina Boluarte, and reiterated Washington's wholehearted support. Kenna, in another post, tweeted the U.S. categorically rejects any extra constitutional act by President Castillo to prevent Congress from fulfilling its mandate. This all showed that the U.S. government had staunchly supported Peru's unelected administration. In a statement, the U.S. State Department stated, the U.S. commends Peru's institutions and authorities for safeguarding democratic stability. Troubled by violent demonstrations and reports of attacks on the press and private property, the U.S. recognizes Dina Boluarte as the country's president.
Peru's Congress overwhelmingly voted to remove Castillo from office and replace him with the vice president. Lawmakers cited his, quote, permanent moral incapacity. The MPs are said to represent the rich in Peru. Pedro Castillo, a provincial school teacher, had promised to restructure Peru's economy to favor the poor, which went against the interests of big business, and this may have been the catalyst behind his ouster. That brings an end to the International Bulletin.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Under the starry sky of the desert, from the very heart of evergreen forests, with the radiance of silver-colored sand. In the midst of proud mountains, closer, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Attractive to anyone in today's hectic world is that we Iranians have a part in our rich culture which is called Pahlevani culture. I try to define this phrase for you, but believe me, there are many values in Iranian culture which are hard to define for others since they are rooted in the rich history and culture of Iran. Let me say it in this way. Pahlevani culture grows people who are physically strong like a hero or a champion. But at the same time, this culture teaches these heroes to be humble, to have a gentle soul, strong will, and ethical and moral values. This culture is mostly practiced in a sports club called Zurkhane. And the sport which is practiced is called Bastani or Pahlevani sport. This sport is exclusively Iranian. By the way, I am at the subway. I'm going to visit Shahid Fahmide Zurkhane. Well, here we arrived. Pahlevani culture, beginning in ancient Iran, has affected all the nations and countries that once upon a time were part of this great land. Pahlevani culture and sport is an ancient sport rooted in the rich Iranian culture that connects the power of soul and body. Pahlevani and Zurkhane rituals are one of those traditions which carry a rich ethical culture within. The name has been inscribed by UNESCO for ورزش پهلوانی, heroic sport, or ورزش باستانی, ancient sport, which refers to traditional wrestling or a system of athletics originally used to train Iranian warriors in Persia and the adjacent lands. It combines martial arts, calisthenics, strength training, and music, and pursues a state of spiritual peace and self-control in human's body and mind. Recognized by UNESCO as among the world's longest-running forms of such training, it fuses elements of pre-Islamic Iranian culture, which is clearly seen in Ferdowsi's versified Shahnameh, and later with Islam entering Iran with the spirituality of Shia Islam. Each element in Pahlavani sport represents the humbleness of the athletes doing the sport, their gentle soul, strong will, and powerful body. The ancient sport has been practiced as a means of training warriors for the battlefield since the Achaemenid Empire and was systematized as the sport we see today about 700 years ago. Here I am at Hasanabad Square of Tehran. There is not much left to the Zurkhane and I prefer to take a walk to my destination. There are a few blocks on the northern part of Park Shah. So, here it is. Let's go inside. Of this Zurkhane. The walls are decorated with pictures of athletes, holy places, verses, and war martyrs. The ceremony has just started. The beginning of the ritual is marked by the murshid or master beating a goblet drum. The murshid is the highest rank in the Zurkhane. He sits at the most elevated spot and sings religious tunes, heroic poems from Persian literature and verses of Noble Quran, or repeats names of Shia Imams to pump up the athletes. Then the athletes enter the octagonal pit called the Goud, which is sunken around 1 meter into the floor of Zurkhane. Stone seats are built around the Goud for spectators. Athletes form a circle around a veteran athlete called the Miandar. Then they follow his lead. Zurkhane moves and tunes have an exclusive terminology, and the instruments used by the athletes symbolize ancient weapons. The three main instruments found in every Zurkhane are meals, wooden clubs that resemble war mixes, kapode, an iron rod with a hand grip on one side connected with chains on its ends, which symbolizes bows used in ancient war times, and sang, or enormous heavy panels that resemble shields. Sang literally means stone, and in the past they would be made of stone, but these days they are mainly made of heavy wood. Pahlavani culture can be a beneficent, good, and moral way for living in today's world that is in need of ethical and moral values for the betterment of human beings.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The delegation of the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, is in Iran's capital, Tehran, to discuss the so-called outstanding issues, including the agency's probe. This visit came when, just one day earlier, Iran's nuclear agency chief, Islami, said the country's capacity to enrich uranium has more than doubled in its entire history, up to 60%, and that's up from 3.67% allowed under the nuclear deal. Now, why would Iran make that announcement now, and what will be the reaction of the IAEA, along with the U.S. and the EU, for that matter? Can't forget Israel either. Those are some of the key questions we'll be asking in this edition of The Spotlight. First, let me introduce our guests. Fuad Izadi, professor at the University of Tehran, joins us from Tehran. Also joining us is Yusuf Azizi, international affairs expert, who joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome to you both. Fuad Izadi, I'll first start with you. Welcome to the program. Taking a look at the IAEA statement on this visit, it has said it's at the invitation of Iran, and it's a technical team that's going to be visiting, that's visiting Tehran. Basically, taking a look at just the invitation itself, given the fact that Iran has extended that invitation, doesn't that show Iran's goodwill and gesture and willingness to actually cooperate with the agency after everything that it's been through? And we're going to discuss some of that in order to, as Mr. Islami said, to straighten out any ambiguities or questions that the IAEA may have.
You know, this is actually going beyond what we just described. We know that IAEA director coordinates his statements and his actions with the Israeli entity. He visited Israel a few months ago. He is in contact with Israeli officials constantly. He basically repeats what he hears from the Israelis. And for Iran to be working with this particular individual is going much beyond normal concessions that the country would generally give. And it has been the decision of Iranian officials to engage in these type of contacts to make sure that no one could accuse Iran of not cooperating with IAEA, even with this director of IAEA. So Iran is going beyond any reasonable and logical action. As you know, Iran is inspected more than any other country in the world. And sooner or later, I think Iranian officials will get tired of this type of behavior that we see from IAEA. And I think the window of opportunity that IAEA has to continue to work with Iran is not very long.
Okay, so that's a key way of putting it towards the end there that I'd like to ask you, Yusuf Azizi, as to when is Iran going to get tired? I mean, we're looking at this invitation that was extended by Iran coming on the heels of, in a matter of 6 months, two resolutions executed against Iran by the Board of Governors of the IAEA, given the fact, of course, the country behind it was the U.S. mainly. But even after that, Iran still said, okay, let's give the IAEA an invitation to come to Iran in order to, again, clear up any questions or ambiguities. But the key question here being, when will Iran get tired, do you think?
So as we know, the Iran's precondition to revive the JCPOA, one of the preconditions is to resolve this allegation against Iran's nuclear program. There is three cases or documents against Iran that recently adopted by some members, like Israel's government against Iran. But, you know, I believe that never ever in the near future, the Iran and the IAEA will finish their cooperation. Because as long as Iran is part of the NPT, Iran do whatever it can under the NPT. So going beyond or even in the 60% enrichment of uranium, it's not against the NPT. So Iran is still cooperate with IAEA, and we know that also European countries, they agreed about 3 months ago in August that, okay, these three documents against Iran allegations should be resolved before the whole JCPOA revived, and all of the countries go back to the their obligations. But again, the United States put some issues against this condition that all of the parties agreed on that. So my understanding is that Iran and Iran and the IAEA would, you know, cooperate in a level that it's not going to finish everything, because the finishing everything is mean that Iran go out of the NPT and the European countries, you know, put the put end at the for the JCPOA, and all of the sanctions, the UN sanctions, go back to the Iran. So I think nobody's, no parties would like to go to that kind of situation. It is not in the benefit of either parties. And this kind of negotiation, this kind of talking to resolve these issues is necessary for all sides. We don't know if the United States, after the election, the Congress election, the midterm election in the United States last November, if the United States is now going to resolve these little and small phrases, disagreement phrases in the final reviving agreement, because we know that right now and in the next 2 or 3 months, the Biden administration has open-handed to revive the JCPOA. If they are not going and they are not deciding very diligently to revive the JCPOA, again, the United States domestic policy go to the loop of the presidential election and the primary election of the U.S. president in 2024, and the, again, the Biden administration cannot revive the JCPOA.
All right, let's talk about what happened a day earlier, Fouad Azadi, and that was a major announcement that Iran made, where the Iran's nuclear agency chief said the country's capacity, from what I'm reading, to enrich uranium has more than doubled in its entire history, of which the enrichment has reached a level of 60%. Of course, that's something that was due not to be in the deal itself, but because the U.S. pulled out of it. So Iran did have the right to do what it has done. Why do you think Iran decided to make that announcement one day before the IAEA arrived in the capital, Tehran?
You know, Iran was following JCPOA 1 year, more than 1 year after the United States left the agreement. So I think if it wasn't for Iran, we would not have any JCPOA. And the Biden administration has been in office for almost 2 years. And Biden could return to the agreement on the first day of his presidency, the same way he returned to the Paris Climate Accords on his first day of presidency. He could just nullify Trump's executive order. The new presidents get to do that in the United States if they want. And he didn't. He wanted to drag his feet and keep talking, keep demanding new things. And the end result is that a lot of Iranian leaders are realizing that just waiting for the United States on these issues is not in the national interest of Iran. Iran is a member of NPT, and I'm sure you have read the text. There is no place in NPT that tells you to what percentage you can enrich. It doesn't have the number 60% or 3% or 90%. Countries are allowed to enrich uranium for peaceful purposes to any degree of enrichment that they want. So Iran could do 90% or 95% or 99%. There are no limitations on that. in NPT. You know, people who wrote the non-proliferation treaty were experts in nuclear physics, at least some of them were, and they could put that limitation in the text. They decided not to do that, and the end result is that countries like Iran will use whatever enriched uranium they need to have as members of NPT.
Okay. Well, let's talk about this point, but in a different way, if we can, Yusuf Azizi. And I'd like to ask you what has been said before. It's actually a repeated point, but it is worth discussing that this whole thing is a manufactured crisis, that this is not about Iran's civilian nuclear program or the fact that the statements or the posturing or the views out there were either coming from the U.S. or Israel or any of their allies, that Iran may be after the nuclear bomb or is after the nuclear bomb or weaponization of the nuclear program. That is just all posturing in a sense and is put out there because they know that Iran's leader has issued a fatwa, at least that's what is known, that it would never pursue that path. So given that premise, what are the points of friction that hasn't been able to work out, if that's even possible to ask a question like that, in order for you to explain it to us?
Yeah, as you said, if it is it was only the Iran nuclear program, it should be resolved in 2003 when the Western countries engaged with Khatami administration and especially the three European countries, Germany, France, and England, has discussed and negotiated and reached to agreement three times with Iranian administration. But again, the Bush administration at that time, they said that, okay, there is no zero enrichment in Iran. There is some crazy policy of United States. So if it is just the Iran nuclear program, it should be resolved a long time ago. But as you said, I believe that when Iranian announced this progress in their enrichment and in their nuclear capability, it is because that the Western countries right now, especially the United States, sees the negotiation, especially from the Iranian side, as the weaker point, because they see that the unrest, the recent unrest in Iran, weakened the Iranian position on the table. On the other hand, we know that since September, August, when the world knows that the negotiation goes after the United States election in November, each party tried to build some strategic cards to, you know, negotiate later on the table. They didn't go just to, you know, talk to the capital and waste the time. So from the American perspective, I think they find out or they believe or they expected that Iranian comes to the negotiation table with the weaker position because of the unrest. And on the other side, the Iranian try to bring the 60% to at Fordo and also use the most advanced centrifuge they built on. So they try to make some strategy card to play on later on the negotiation table. This is my understanding that both sides, all sides, wanted to revive the JCPOA. But the elements in the revival agreement is very important, and we are maybe in the last phases of the reviving this agreement.
Fadazadi, I was trying to come up with a statement that Iran's leader actually made regarding the riots, as we call it, inside Iran. I believe one of the things that he did say, and I can't paraphrase him, I mean, I can't quote him exactly, so I'm going to have to paraphrase, is the fact that he said that one of the reasons that these riots have occurred and this whole scenario is being played out inside of Iran is because the U.S. wanted to get concessions from Iran that it wasn't getting when the sanction removal talks were happening. And therefore, this was one of their strategies in order for Iran to come to the table and therefore have a weaker hand. They're associating, they call it the protests, we call it riots, they're associating that with getting nuclear concessions. Is that something that is actually happening, do you think?
Well, let me first say that they call, they use the word protesters or protests. Press TV says they're rioting, they're riots. And I think Press TV is too soft, actually. These are vigilantes, criminals. that are killing police officers. When you have riots, generally you don't have people killing police officers. You have criminals killing police officers. So calling these people protesters is actually insulting the people who are actually protesting. Protesters don't kill police officers. Rioters don't kill police officers. Criminals kill police officers. Vigilantes kill police officers. You know, they people, a couple of them have been executed. The people who are engaging in these type of activities would not be tolerated in any country. That is what Iran is doing. That's the first point. The second point, yes.
Well noted.
The United States is trying to use what's going on in Iran as a way of pressuring the Iranian government for more concessions. They're failing. The Iranian government is not going to negotiate in this manner under pressure. And what is actually beneficial to a lot of people in Iran is seeing what the West is all about. The hatred that they have towards Muslim women, if they observe the hijab, they are going to be called names in countries like France. They're going to face difficulties in a good number of Western countries. They want to use this issue to put pressure on the Iranian government. And people realize what this is all about. So overall, I think that strategy is failing miserably. And the fact that Iran started an increased level of nuclear activity yesterday is a sign for that statement.
Okay, I just happened to glance over at the time. We just got a few minutes left here. So, Yusuf Azizi, I think one of the things that I need to ask you are the issue of sanctions. Now, it's interesting that the U.S. Special Representative assigned to Iran's case has said that Iran is the one that has walked back and rejected the deal on more than one occasion. You have to ask them why that has happened. But it's interesting how it says, this is, again, something that I'm quoting from him, what we were prepared to do was to lift those sanctions that were supposed to be lifted under the JCPOA and which had been put back into effect by the Trump administration. And he also says sanctions are not the answer. If he says that, then why is it that there hasn't been an agreement on the sanctions, which Iran says purely and simply that it needs to be lifted?
Yeah, as you know, the Iranian position is that we are going to back to the 2015 JCPOA, not one word less or more. United States tell the same, but it's a little bit different here, and it is because of the different interpretation from both sides. The United States put more sanctions as entities and people and persons and everything in Iran, and also it shows that the next administration could easily come out again, and there is no guarantee for United States politics and domestic politics and United States Constitution. There is no guarantee here that United States want to abide by that, any agreement, any international agreement, especially against countries like Iran or mid-level power in the world. So the Iranians said this time, if we revive the JCPOA, there is no countries or major companies to come and invest in Iran. It is just only selling some hundred thousand more oil for a limited time. And it is not worth it. It is not worth it that we spend all of this money and efforts to, circumvent the sanction or build on our nuclear power, nuclear energy. And again, because there's no guarantee, because of 1 year or 2 year or maybe 6 months, we just destroy everything. Who is going to pay this, consumption? So there are many arguments here, and I think after this unrest and putting all of these sanctions about the human rights, terrorism, everything else, so we know that if there is a revival on JCPOA, there should be a limited amount of benefits, very, very limited amount of benefits in the time and the scope of benefit, economic benefits for Iran.
Well, let's have your take on that, Fuad Azadi, in terms of the way that the sanctions have impacted the economy, because at the other side of the coin, we are entering a new phase when it comes to Iran's interaction with the world in terms of the shift that is happening. But my final question has to be on sanctions also to you, Fuad Azadi, because as you said, we won't call them riots. The vigilantes and U.S.'s association with that, Robert Malley has said, our focus is on the vigilantes, or he doesn't call them vigilantes, but we'll call them that. Our focus is on the vigilantes, on what's happening inside of Iran. But when he says that, isn't that then consequential? Because people are not getting life-saving medicines. The sanctions are actually making life harder for that sector that needs that. So isn't that something that the U.S. needs to consider, even though they have said medicine is exempt from sanctions?
Yes, they are exempt from sanctions, but because of banking sanctions, Iran cannot pay for the medicine that the country needs, and in effect, you will have sanctions on medicine. That's what happens in practice. You know, we need to remember that the problem that exists with regard to U.S. returning to JCPOA is the difficulties that the Biden administration has with the U.S. Congress. You have all the Republicans that are opposed to the nuclear agreement, with the exception of one, maybe. And then you have very powerful Democrats like Robert Menendez or Chuck Schumer, people who are leading Democrats in the Senate, that are also opposed. Robert Menendez has said this very clearly for months. And that's the difficulty that the U.S. has. But instead of acknowledging that, they are using other terminologies that are not really helpful.
Thank you very much, Fuad Azadi, professor at the University of Tehran. Yusuf Aziz, a pleasure, international affairs expert from Washington, D.C. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Takwe and the team, it's goodbye.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.